Good evening. KQRIW here. It's time to begin the tech test. Sorry, I'm a little bit late. At this time, Mel, KQKEY, and Dick try to answer people's questions, or at least gather those who think they've got answers to the questions. This hobby of ham radio is a little bit on the complicated side, so we're all on a learning curve. We're all in the discovery period as to how all this jazz works. How does radio really work, and how to make it work better? A person who has a question or a comment for the net signs in by getting mail and take your call letters and your name, followed by a yes if you do have a question or a comment. So do we have any check-ins at this time? Could you give me your call letters and name right now?
This is 82QYW. My name is Joe.
Joe recognized. Anyone else?
KQKNG. Rich is just with me.
And WS2N, Paul, with a question from last week.
KC2MET, Steve, no question.
KC2RXV, Ben, and just listening.
WJ2B, just listening.
KB1NMH, just listening.
W2QGZ, no question, good evening.
Seeing all this is
N2EJ, just listening.
N2GOT, no.
WB2HWW, no.
KC2BYV, Dan, listening for a moment.
WB2HWW, no.
KB2BBV, no.
My goodness. What a bunch of chickens. Wow. More than normal. Mel, Joe, Rich, Steve, Ben, a whole bunch of them. I couldn't even get a chance to, Bill, couldn't even get a chance to write down all the names, but I got your call letters. Is there anyone else, one last call, with a person with a question or a comment? Give me your call letters and name right now. Okay. The first person who signed in with a real question is Joe, and then Paul in that order. Joe, KC2QIW, I think it's Quebec India Whiskey. Please proceed with your question. And Mel, Dick, and the crew arrived. Crew who are pleasant. We'll see what we can do with your question. You got it, Joe.
Yeah, how you guys doing? My name is Joe. KC2QIW from Harrison, New York, in West Worcester County. Yeah, I guess I have a question. Okay. A couple weeks ago, I was doing my TV thing, making a TV tip, and someone out there, they had an A2-1000Z. My question is, I know that's a ham radio, the A2-1000Z. My question is, that comes with the frequency 2 from the factory?
Not legal.
Okay, now, a number of rigs, as they traverse the frequency region of, let's say, 15 meters around 21 megs and 10 meters around 28 megs, since the frequency for citizen band around 27 megs is in between, the rig itself might not be able to tune there. I can see the possibility of a manufacturer making a piece of equipment which has built-in limits by way of its microprocessor and other techniques, where it can put out 27 megacycles, and it's restricted to 5 watts of output. I can see the possibility of that. I'm having a little trouble believing that the FCC would approve such a piece of electronics because it is so close to being able to transmit, let's say, 100 watts on the adjacent frequencies, that they'd have to worry a little bit about whether or not someone could find a way of doing that. Yes, without a doubt, there are a significant number of people on the citizens' frequencies, citizens' band frequencies, 27 megs, who are violating the requirement of not to exceed 5 watts. Let's face it, a certain number of people are doing that. And a certain number of people get caught doing it and get prosecuted for it. Is that a real crime? Is it a victimless crime? We can have lots of discussions on that one. But the rule is a rule, and the rule is you're not supposed to exceed 5 watts. If you really want to run higher power and talk longer distances, a person should get a ham license, because the ham license these days is so easy to get. No longer a Morse code requirement. You only have to literally memorize some questions, take a sit-down exam, given lots of different places, around every single state, lots of times per year. And so getting a real ham license, and therefore being allowed to transmit 1,000 watts Morse code and 1,500 watts single sideband peak envelope power on adjacent frequencies should give you all the distance and also the fun to actually use the electronics. Ham radio operators are, in some people's minds, a little more interesting to talk to. But that's just a personal opinion. So, to my knowledge, there is no piece of equipment like the AC1000 intended directly to transmit on citizen band frequencies. If I'm wrong on that, somebody comment up and tell me and correct the situation. Give me a call that is right now, K2RIW.
Dick, you can modify it to go on Mars with CAP.
Yeah, any piece of equipment can be modified to a different frequency, a different power output, and so on. So the fact that people can do a modification is a given. Ham radio operators are, by way of their license, allowed to modify their electronics. In other words, if I'm a ham radio operator, and I buy a piece of equipment that's made for the 20 meter ham band, 14 megacycles, and I do a modification so that it's able to go to the 10 meter ham band, 28 megacycles, no problem. In other words, our license allows us to do those kind of modifications. The FCC trusts us to be a good organization of people who are presenting a significant track record of being able to self-police and so on. So the federal government has very little worry about ham radio operators modifying the equipment. But for a citizen band operator to modify his equipment, he has never been given such authorization. Of course, quite a few of them do, and a certain percentage of them are caught doing it. A certain percentage of them are prosecuted for doing it. It's certainly not a recommended thing to do. If you really want high power and longer distance, get a real ham license. In the days when the ham radio license was considerably more difficult to get because of Morse code requirement, and some people have a lot of trouble with Morse code. In many cases, it's psychological, not real, but there are a few cases where it probably is real. And so people did do some shortcutting of not getting the ham license, but running high power on CB. As I see it, that's no longer required because the ham license is so easy to get. And the privileges are so significant. With a ham radio license, you're given a tremendous number of frequencies, a tremendous number of megacycles of bandwidth of frequencies, in which you're allowed to do tremendous numbers of things. Build your own antenna, build your own transmitter, build your own receiver, buy any of the above, whichever you like. So, as I see it, there's very little need anymore for illegally modifying citizen band equipment. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm naive. Anyone want to add anything to that? Give me a call that is right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
2TC Gordon.
Okay, Gordon. You're in and out of the machine a little bit, but go right ahead. W2TTT. By the way, Gordon is the man who runs TechNicalNet on Thursday night. I believe it starts at 7:30 in New Jersey. Go right ahead, Joey Gordon. You probably have encountered some of this yourself. W2TTT, K2RIW.
146.79 at 9 o'clock on Thursdays. Our nets are 9 o'clock. But anyway, Dick, my biggest problem has been my 222 transverter retuning and going to a 30 megahertz IF. The systematically found radios that will operate at 30 megahertz. That's not a problem, but it's always a chore to get the Mars cap off without being a Mars cap person so that I can drive my 222 transverter at 30 megahertz as opposed to 28, because I said to myself, gee, why should I buy a crystal? I can just simply realign the transverter move the IF up. And oh, by the way, in those days, I could operate 2-20 and perhaps even 432 with different IFs on the same general range, but different IFs, so not have IF bleed through, which was a great improvement as well. Q2RW, the whole UCTT, I hope that came through.
Okay, if I understand correctly then, Gordon, you did have a little bit of a drop out there. So your transmitter that was capable of 222 by changing the IF, you were able to make it work on MAWS frequencies as well as the 30 megacycle band. So without a doubt, there are pieces of equipment that require rather little modification. The citizens band operators used to have a relatively small number of frequencies allocated to them. And once Southeast Asia started producing citizen band synthesized transceivers, in other words, they had a frequency synthesizer inside that by a computer command, so to speak, you could dial in whatever frequency you want. And because of numbers of guys discovered that if they broke certain wires inside, there were other citizen band, there were other frequencies a phase lock loop would go to. And the bottom line was, so many people made that modification that there was such a large number of citizen band operators using these brand new frequencies. The FCC had a little recourse other than to legalize those frequencies for citizen band operation. So those guys by the back door got a whole lot of brand new frequencies. Well, that was, 15, 20 years ago. Here we are today with a number of license-free bands, particularly around 900 megacycles among others, where quite a few pieces of equipment are allowed and no license is required. Cordless telephones fall into that category. And the ham radio operators at 900 megacycles share that frequency region, 902 to 928 megacycles, with license-free equipment. The good news is that lots of equipment is available for the 900 meg band that used to be used for cellular telephone, paging systems, or whatever, high-power solid-state transmitters. And so that underused band, ham radio-wise in the United States, is kind of a wide-open territory where a lot more activity can take place if you're so inclined. The slight disadvantage of that band is that with high-power equipment and very good antennas, you would think that moon-bound operation would be possible. Well, it turns out that all of Europe does not have a 900 megacycle ham band. Only North America and South America has it. Europe and Asia, to my knowledge, do not. So your moon-bound operations would be restricted to North and South America. I don't even think Australia has a 900 megacycle ham band, though I stand corrected on that one. I know we've drifted a little bit far left of your original question, Joe, but I'm rather skeptical that ASU-1000 was intentionally designed with a citizen band operation capability in the box. I am guessing that if a person is doing that, he has modified it. And once he has modified it, the next question is, since it's not a piece of equipment already designed for that frequency region, which means it has a type acceptance from the FCC, just the modifying it does not make it legal. A ham radio operator can modify equipment for the ham radio band. To my knowledge, citizen band operators are not allowed to modify any piece of equipment for use on the citizen's band. I stand corrected on that one if someone has information otherwise. Please give me a call that is right now before I pass it back to Joe, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Info.
Okay, person with info, start up with your call letters and your name, sir.
Okay, the call here is November 2, X-ray Echo Oscar. My name is Rich. I'm located in Marlboro. I own an FT-1000D. I know you can't transmit on the CB band. Once you get down to 27 megahertz or so, the screen says general, which means general coverage receiver, and you can't transmit there. Back to next.
KC2MHI.
Okay, thank you for your information, Rich. KC2MHI, I think it was. Start up with your name and your information, sir.
Okay, Dick, the name is Kevin, Kilo Charlie 2, Mike Hotel Yankee. And Dick, you raise A very good question, because let me tell you something. I'm not ashamed to say it. I was a CB radio operator for like over 20 years. And really getting into ham radio, it really helped me. It advanced me a lot. I did have problems basically, you know, passing the code. I took the test twice. I just couldn't really really grip it, man, with the tones and everything. It would just drive me crazy. Hey, but basically on the Navy part, I passed it. I did technician, general, and the last test I took was the extra, amateur extra. And I tell a lot of guys on CB, why you want to really basically, you know, push all that power? It's illegal and stuff like that. And, you know, the people that they bring the radio to addict that basically modified equipment. And, like you said, they're not qualified there, and the type of power that they run in is really, really, really outrageous, you know. And I used to run a little bit there too, and when I find out there, Dick, that you don't have to, I don't really have to worry about a TBI or anything like that, because with VHF and UHF, it's over the television band. You know, which frees me up, and ever since I've been a ham radio operator, I haven't really got no complaints there at all. And as far as some guys modifying it, Dick, you know, they don't listen to nobody. They run the power, and it just basically screw up the neighborhood. And let me tell you something, another thing there, Dick, I was operating as a CB. I did have a big stick on the roof, and the FCC paid me a visit. But I just wasn't home, and they told my neighbor to, you know, have a TBI filter, and that's basically it. I just figured I would share that right along with everybody, and I'm very proud to be an amateur radio operator. It's a privilege, and the place that you talk is it is really great. Back over to you, Dick.
Thank you very much for that testimonial, Kevin. A large number of people first got introduced to electronics and wireless electronics, radio electronics, by way of the citizen's band. So there's some extremely good ham radio operators that first cut their teeth on CB. You could say it was a very humble beginning, but they suddenly discovered ham radio and realized that there's a lot more capability there. Much higher power, much more authorization to modify equipment, larger number of more interesting people to talk to, longer distances to work, a lot more bands, and nowadays so easy to get, not very costly as far as the license is concerned. Lots and lots of equipment on of various brand names are available. To exaggerate a little bit, a man made a quip over 20 years ago, and his funny statement was, a ham radio operator is really a citizen's band operator with a PhD degree. It's an exaggeration, but it gets the point across. There are, for a whole lot of surveys, you could say that there is a slightly higher class of people with a lot more electronic knowledge on ham radio than on CB. So for a person who has the ability to make the shift, and I think that's 98% of the population, I recommend you do it. And whether or not you admit to your fellow amateur radio operators that you first started on CB is your choice. You will experience a little bit of prejudice along those lines. There are some people who think, because they are ham radio operators, that the people who started off as CB operators were somehow a lesser human being. Now, of course, there's no justification for that. But there's a little bit of prejudice everywhere in the world, and sometimes you have to admit it, work on getting rid of it, but of course, and it's usually an educational problem, but you will experience a little bit of that from time to time. So, getting back to Joe's original question, and it does appear, Joe, that we've sort of closed the loop, that that Yaesu 1000 Delta rig was not made for citizen band operation. A person who's there transmitting with it, not just using it as a general coverage receiver, is quite possibly demonstrating the fact that he has illegally modified a piece of equipment. And so I don't recommend it, and if you could talk that fellow into going to get his ham radio license and then using his Yaesu 1000D on the frequencies where the thing will really shine, he's going to get a lot more bang for the dollar and a lot more pleasure out of electronics in general. and wireless electronics is, as you can tell by the fact that this technical net has been around for 25 years and 3 months now, and so there are people who want to come together and discuss the subject because it is both so interesting, but simultaneously it is also so fascinating because it has so much capability, but it is, if you want to really be an expert in the area, I can tell you it's a pretty high mountain to climb. It will not bore you because you won't run out of new things to learn. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter repeater type ham radio with or without a handy talkie or a base station rig or a mobile rig. That's just one of the 26 kinds. There's 25 other kinds. So if what you think is ham radio bores you and you think there's nothing left of interest, try one of the other 25 kinds before you give up. And there are kinds of ham radio that are heavily oriented toward the integration of computer hardware with electronic hardware. The Joe Taylor technique, the K2JT, for instance, is a computer-generated kind of Morse code which has extremely long-range capability, where it's able to dig a signal at 28 dB below the noise level and able to give you 95% copy of that signal, whether it got to you by way of traversing 1,000 miles beyond your horizon, or got there by way of sporadic e-propagation, meteor scatter, moon bounce, whatever. That's just one of a number of very high technology, modern-day techniques that the ham radio operators are coming up with. So you're in the right place, Joe. KC2QIW for any further comments. K2LIW in the TechNet.
WD3XW in a comment.
Okay, I'm going to get back to you in a second, Howie. Joe first, go right ahead, Joe.
Okay, thank you, guys. Answer my questions and everything. The first question that you asked, I'm going to try to get that guy over to my club over there in Yonkers. So I joined the Yonkers Amateur Radio Club in Yonkers over there. And there's a few guys out there. One guy has, I think it's an ICOM 700. He's mobile, and he's built on the Citizen Band, and I'm trying to get him involved. Because those guys out there, they love the amateur radio. It's funny because they're like, hey Joe, you should get into ham radio, and they were in shock that I told them, yes I am. I'm a technician. I belong to the ARRL club, and I also belong to the amateur radio, Yonkers Amateur Radio Club. All right, so I'm gonna pass to the other station out there, and thank you for the answers.
Very fine, Joe. Come back anytime you want to with further questions or comments as to how things are going with the Yonkers Amateur Radio Club. And it's going to be a little bit of an uphill battle to convert a person who has spent a lot of time on CB into ham radio. One slight advantage, unfortunately, he has on Citizens Band is that since the majority of people there are running the 5 watts, which is legal, and if a person runs some considerably higher amount of power, he has the ability to be king on the mountain for a short period of time before the FCC visits him. So some people are very tempted by that. Well, within ham radio operators, you can also be king of the mountain by putting up a bigger antenna and a higher power transmitter, and there you're allowed to do it. 1,500 watts peak envelope power on sideband is allowed. 1,000 watts key down in Morse code is allowed. Antenna as big as your property will tolerate. There's no restrictions on that. And so if you want to have a strong enough signal, you can bounce it off the moon. You can easily do that. I won't say easily, but hundreds of people have done it. And as long as you're able to convince the Federal Communications Commission that your antenna is going to be aimed up in the air at the moon, for certain kinds of experiments, you can get a special temporary authorization, a special temporary authority from the FCC to run even higher amounts of power. And a certain number of hams have done that. Now, Howie, I wonder if you've ever been tempted to get a special temporary authority to run high power. WB2HW, go ahead with your comment, Howie.
Hi, Dick. I got into CB when I was 7 years old with a walkie-talkie, and then got a CB, and the rest is history. Let me make one more comment with something. Last night, just to let you know, on repeater, police.
He did get a half a dick, and it's been a great hobby. K2RIW, WD2HWW.
It sure is a great hobby. And when you make further comments downrange, you're probably going to have to go to the higher power, Howie. And what I think is going on here is that somebody is jealous of Howie. Howie has a disability. Despite that disability, he has established an extremely nice website that describes ham radio and his particular 10-meter repeater operation as a very nice repeater. And there are people out there who are jealous of him, and obvious by the fact that they think it is fun to jam his signal. And what the person is doing who's doing that is demonstrating the fact that he is jealous and displeased with his own performance, because he hasn't achieved what Howie has achieved. So it's sad that there are people out there who have that problem. Hopefully they'll eventually come around and join the normal ham radio groups. Alrighty. Paul is another person with a comment, or no, Paul has a question. And we look forward to Paul's questions. Paul is the man who keeps us up to date on what NASA is doing in space. And boy, there's some very interesting satellites having been launched and about to be launched in the very near future. So when it comes around to your space report, we'll be looking forward to that, Paul. But right now, go right ahead with your question. WS2M, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very good. This is WS2N, and just a follow-up from last week, Dick. It's really a theory question. That's what I'm really after. And unfortunately, it doesn't have to do with ham radio. It has to do with a car, actually a 1990 Honda car, that the speedometer and the rest of the car functions off of this one component, component that is attached to the transmission. It's a sensor. It's a speed sensor. So for the people that were on here last week, that's what I'm talking about here. This component failed, knocking out the speedometer and creating flashing lights, and, you know, different engine lights that come on, and an S light that lights up. And you go to the book, and that tells you probably the transmission. And make a long story short, I got this thing fixed by a transmission guy in my area out here in Ronkonkoma, Suffolk County. So, you know, he gave me the component and took it all apart, tried to figure out what's wrong with it. The reason they say something's wrong with it is the computer codes come up and they say, okay, this is the part that needs to be changed. He changes it out, it works. So, well, you know, what makes it tick on the inside? That's what I was interested in. So I took the thing apart. It's only about 2 inches by 2 inches by maybe 1 inch thick, and it bolts to the top of the transmission, and apparently there's a shaft that spins this piece that's inside. Did not see the shaft. I don't know how that would be attached, but this piece does spin. This shaft does spin inside this little gadget, and it spins a magnet. So we went through this last week, and I remember you asked me a lot of questions, Dick, on try this and try that, and because I was trying to find in the magnet itself, trying to find out if there was a north, south. Everything looked like it was just one direction, you know, just all north. And somebody, I don't know if it was you or somebody, said, well, the magnet might be overwhelming it. Maybe Mel said that. Overwhelming the other, you know, the magnet I'm trying to test with, trying to get a reverse polarity on it, using a regular bar magnet to see if I can get a repulsion from it. And that was the case. It was definitely pulling, no matter what you did, how you turned it or rotated this spinning magnet. So, Dick, what I did is I took a compass. I mentioned on the net I should try a compass, a regular compass, and put it a couple inches away. And as you turn the magnet, sure enough, there is a spot, I'll call it a null, and like 240 degrees worth of this thing tends to be no reaction. But then you get to this one area, roughly about 120 degrees, and particularly near the top of it, the you know, this magnet apparently, you know, favored near the top. And so there is a space in there where the, so essentially it's probably like a really like a horseshoe magnet spinning, but it looks like one solid object, one sphere, not sphere, one disc that's spinning. So one thing led to another. Okay, now I mentioned there was this black case. I had to rip it apart. I used the Dremel tool to do it. To cut the section of the thing apart, it was a like a polyurethane, a black substance, just a sealed unit, and what looked like should be a coil on the bottom. Well, you know, a spinning magnet should have a coil, and that probably sends the signal out to the what would be that spins will tell the computer how fast you're going, and everything should work fine. So I dig down into this, and as I open it up, it turns out there's a circuit board built into this thing. It's black, so I'm after you clear every circuit board. And Dick says a couple of resistors, the diodes. I measured two of the resistors I was able to measure. They were a little on a larger size, they were 180 ohms. Diodes, and there was a small chip mounted on this PC board. Still no coil. I'm digging down, and where is this freaking coil? And I couldn't find it. And it's this chip, I read the chip, it was 8340 UAS. Don't know what it means. Put it into the internet. The internet came up, I could buy 100 of them. It didn't tell me what it was. I searched one of them. I couldn't tell what type of a chip this thing was. Then I dig down further. No coil, zero coil. Then I realized that at the one point where the top part of this magnet would pass, there was this little black thing. We're looking at something in a microscope. See, I mean, I did it with a magnifying glass, 5 pound magnifying glass. And sure enough, I could see it was, you know, these little numbers, and this black, I'm going to call it a chip, but I mean, I broke it apart. It didn't look like a chip to me, but this black thing is apparently the pickup, and it's OHD, Oscar Hotel Delta 20, and then below that is A014, and before, you know, on top of it is a tiny little M, maybe that's for, you know, maybe the manufacturer, I don't know. Whatever this little thing is, yeah, I mean, it just had four little wires going in into it, and then going into this little PC board, and then that was it. Now out of this whole PC board come three wires, one black wire around the side to the computers, the different parts of the different part of it. Well, this whole long story is there is no coil, and it's just a magnetic field passing this thing, this, I'm going to call it a chip, this pickup, along with that, and I can't find this OHD 20, A14 thing. Whatever that thing is, that thing must be sensing this magnetic field breaking and contacting, over and over again, and then sending the information to the PC board and then off of the computer. That's what I found on it, Dick. Just to let you know, and the question is, I wonder if anybody has ever seen a magnetic field besides using a relay or something of that nature to activate something. This thing didn't look like a relay. If it was, it was the world's smallest one. I wonder if anybody's ever heard of that type of thing, Dick. Have you? K2RIW, WS2R.
Fantastic. J2B, I think it was. We'll get to you in a minute. J2B. I may have covered up some of your call letters. What you guys are hearing is an example of what I've been saying for some time. To me, my philosophy, and I think Mel may share this philosophy, inside of a real ham radio operator is the scientist trying to get out. We want to know how Mother Nature makes all these things work. How does radio work? How do computers work? And so on. So we love taking things apart and investigating them. And Paul had this beautiful opportunity. He had this failure of the sensor on his Honda automobile. The garage was kind enough to give him the defective part. It cost him nothing. He's able to take it apart and figure out what's going on. My first question, Paul, was when you finally held the magnet far enough away that you could sense the magnetic field out of your little rod that was part of the sensor network without having it overpowered by too strong a magnet, was it magnetized from end to end? I think the answer is no. I'm going to guess it was magnetized in a, not an axial manner, that was end to end, but a radial manner. In other words, as you rotated this thing near a compass, rotated about its axis, not rotated end to end, but rotated about its axis. I bet you saw the compass in front, so that it was quite possibly magnetized in a crosswise direction from 12 o'clock towards 6 o'clock when you look at one end of this round tubular object. Second of all, when it comes to sensing magnetic fields, there's at least three ways of doing it, probably four. The conventional way in the old days is with a coil. And as magnetic field cuts the turns of a coil, by Lenz's law, you introduce voltage into that coil. You could say a generator operates by that means. Second of all, they make these little reed switches that are used inside of the actuator for my satellite system. My satellite actuator has a turns counter inside. And there's a small magnet on one of the things that rotates. The worm drive has got a magnet on the end of it, and each time the magnet goes sweeping by a reed switch, the reed switch closes, makes a pulse. The pulse goes down the two wires and tells the control box in my house that, yes, I just moved a tenth of a degree, so to speak. And it keeps track of those pulses to know where it is. So a reed switch magnetic sensor is one approach. A more sophisticated approach is called a Hall effect device. I am guessing that that OHD20A014 device is a Hall effect device. A Hall effect device requires four wires to operate. And the way it operates is that two of the wires, let's assume you've got a rectangular chunk of material which is so carefully selected to emphasize the Hall effect. And you have a rectangular chunk of material which is taller than it is wide. And so from the 12 o'clock point to the 6 o'clock point, you have two ohmic contacts, and you pass current between those two points. You have another set of contacts at 9 o'clock, at 3 o'clock on this rectangular device. Ordinarily, the voltage difference between the 9 o'clock and the 3 o'clock position is 0 volts of difference, even though current is flowing at right angles between 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock. However, when you put a magnetic field in the presence of a Hall effect device, the current flowing from 12 o'clock towards 6 o'clock gets deflected either to the right or to the left, depending on the orientation and strength of the magnetic field. So the current being deflected off of the center line means that some of the current either favors the right-hand contact at 6 o'clock or the left-hand contact at 3 o'clock. Therefore, you develop a number of millivolts of potential difference between those two contacts. That's the way the Hall effect device works. I am guessing that this integrated circuit chip you've got inside of there, the 8340 UAS, is made to be a device issuing the current into the Hall effect device, and also it's got an amplifier that measures the voltage differential that comes out of the Hall effect. That's just a guess on my part. And so Mr. J2B, I think he's also got a guess. Let's see, give us your full call letters and your name, sir, and then your comment. K2LIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick and everybody on it. This is Whiskey Juliet 2 Bravo. Name here is Joe. And I would definitely agree with you, Dick, that this is probably a Hall effect device from that port terminal. And also that the output shaft on the transmission doesn't turn very rapidly at low speed. So a Hall effect device is good at measuring very slowly changing magnetic fields and even a static magnetic field. So they use it for DC current. I worked for a company that made clamp-on ammeters, and the DC clamp-ons usually will use Hall effect devices to measure a DC magnetic field, which is proportional to the current, to give you a current reading. So for slowly changing fields, the Hall effect sensor is a good way to go. So that's probably what's been enriched sensor in. So that's how you do it.
Fantastic. Joe, you just brought forth a very, another good piece of information. when you're backing up with your rotomobile, people tend to back up very slowly, maybe half a mile per hour. And as such, when you're moving very, very slowly, if you were trying to pick up the magnetic field by way of a coil, you'd be picking up extremely small amounts of voltage. Whereas with a Hall effect device, which can pick up magnetic field steady state, doesn't have to be changing. You could have a Hall effect device dwell for a half hour in the north-south direction and another half hour in the south-north direction. And in one case, it'll give you a positive voltage, and in the other case, it'll give you a negative voltage coming out. So because a person could periodically drive very slowly and therefore turn his transmission over very slowly, it's beginning to sound like either a reed switch or a Hall effect device. I favor a Hall effect device from what I'm hearing. It sounds like Joe believes it also. Interesting bit of research you're doing there, Paul. Once again, Paul, when you did sense the magnetic field of that magnetized rod, do you believe that as you changed its orientation towards your compass, that you saw evidence of it being magnetized in a radial manner from 12 o'clock to 6 o'clock when you look at one end, as opposed to being magnetized in an axial manner from end to end? What's your guess on that one, Paul? WS2N. The scientist of Ronkonkoma, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Can you tell us the plot number again, Paul?
Okay, and a Hall effect device would be, I copied, OHC, Hotel, no, Oscar Hotel Delta, 20, and then I have A, which is Alpha, 014, now that zero could be an Oscar, you know, it's very hard to see this. And, Dick, yes, from 12 o'clock to 6 o'clock, you got it, exactly right. And it is definitely four little wires going into this thing. And I see what fouled me up, when I broke this thing apart, it separated from the front piece. Now, on a PC board, I'm looking at four little wires sticking out. You know, I didn't know that they broke off from this little piece, and it wasn't until I really got down there with a magnifying glass that I noticed this other piece. I'm going to call it encapsulated part of this, the face that gets near the magnet, and sure enough, I saw these teeny tiny numbers there. And then when I broke that apart with a couple of pairs of needle-nose pliers, after writing the numbers down, it just shattered, and you could just see little tiny wires that were in there, how it was arranged. It was destroyed after it cracked, but it's probably like that. So you're saying a current is going through, and then the magnetic field disturbs that current, and therefore the lens law is out. You don't even need that. Apparently that's what you're saying, Dick. You don't need the changing field like you do in a coil. This thing is affecting the flow of electrons through those little wires in the sensor deck. Yeah, okay, that's the part number that I copied the other station I had, so maybe I'll come up with it. Dick, back to you.
It's the KEY.
Now recognize, my first guess is going to be that the OH Oscar Hotel Delta 20 is the part number, and the Alpha 014 might be the date code. What some companies will do is 2001, 2002, 2003, they'll assign those A, B, C, and then the 014 might indicate the 14th week of that year for the time of manufacture. Those four wires going into that Hall effect device are all connecting to a piece of semiconductor material. I didn't make that clear. A rectangular bar of semiconductor material with current flowing from 12 o'clock to 6 o'clock will have no voltage differential between the contacts at 3 o'clock and 9 o'clock. However, when a magnetic field exists, that current flowing through the semiconductor material from 12 o'clock to 3 o'clock gets deflected to the left or the right and develops a potential difference. That's a quick sketch as to how a Hall effect device works. And now you know the words to look up. You can do a Google search on Hall effect, and I guarantee there's a Wikipedia on that one that'll give you a beautiful explanation, and much better than mine. But I bet you Mel's got another explanation. Let's see what he thinks. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, this is K2KEY. My brother's friend is a transmission specialist here in Coney Island. Worked for a fairly big place. So In fact, I mentioned it to him. I'll give him a call after. He's a pretty good guy to talk to. I want to say hello to him anyhow. Known him for many years. And he says, hey, yeah, they got a couple of these sensors now on the transmission. One is for the speedometer. He's a solid-state system now for the speedometer, of course. And the other one, I asked him this, how I described it, basically the fault that he said, oh, yeah, he says it's the equivalent to what they used to call the vacuum modulator, which I have on my old car, my transmission, that they used the vacuum system, and it was called the vacuum modulator. So they made that into a solid-state system, Dick, because they basically the transmissions now are more computerized. So this is basically that what it does is the old equipment is what they used to call the vacuum modulator take over.
Yeah, the purpose of the vacuum modulator was two purposes. Number one, your whole computing system for the transmission used to sense the state of what the engine is doing by the amount of vacuum that was present in the carburetor. That told you something about engine RPM and the amount of load the engine was under. Second of all, there was a system of valves that opened and closed some of that vacuum from the carburetor into a motor, I'm going to call it, an actuator, and it worked by vacuum, and it would really push on a rod that would shift your transmission from first gear into second gear. So there was all kinds of vacuum-operated, diaphragm-like motor actuator things that used to be in an old-fashioned transmission. And when that diaphragm failed, your carburetor would start sucking its vacuum through that broken diaphragm, and you would start sucking the oil out of your transmission. And in the old days, you could tell when your vacuum modulator was defective and needed replacement. Not only did the car not shift correctly, but suddenly discovered that the transmission was low on fluid, and you saw this red dye inside of the carburetor, because transmission fluid in those days had a red dye to it. And when you saw a red color when you looked down the throat of the carburetor, you knew that there was something there that needed repair. Nowadays, it's all computer-controlled, electronic, and so our transmissions are smarter and no longer need these vacuums, no longer need all that tubing. A piece of wire is a lot easier to route to the transmission than is a vacuum hose, and it's a lot more foolproof. Although in your particular case, I'm guessing either that Hall effect device or the microprocessor or integrated circuit chip, the 8340 UAS that was connected to it, you had some kind of a failure there. But it sounds like we're slowly zeroing in on how this thing works, how a Honda operates, and now some of the mystery of what the Southeast Asia automobile manufacturers have done. Some of that mystery is slowly disappearing by your efforts there, Paul. Anyone with any further questions or comments on all this, K2LAW in the TechNet, give me a call. That is the name right now. Okay, Gordon, I could hear you on the input, but through the machine, you came through only 10% of the time. I think I've got to have a quick discussion with Andy of A2CDL. I have the impression that the squelch control on this repeater is set a little bit on the tight side. In other words, the squelch only opens up when you've got almost a deadpool quieting signal, and occasionally a slightly noisy signal should be let through so that people in the hinterlands can get through. And I bet you if I know Andy, he's got a remote control on the squelch control where he can set it remotely and open things up a little bit. Andy, if the A2CDL, if you happen to be there, did I make some good guesses or bad guesses on this one? W2CDL, K2RIW.
I'm happy that you acknowledged me because I wanted to talk to you about something anyway. At least I wanted to bring something up to the TechNet. No, the squelch was not changed. However, there is some atmospheric interference. And with the wind conditions, if you've been outside, the winds have really picked up. They must be at least speeds of 30 to 40 miles an hour. I do notice that when it does get windy, due to things moving around on the roof of the building, there is some more static developed. Might have a loose mast or coupling or something. So that's what I do notice from time to time. But the squelch has not changed. And while I have it, Dick, one more thing. I want to get into the discussion that we spoke about earlier, because I think it'll be apropos for the net, about stacking Yagi antennas. And it just so happens that your name is mentioned in this article. So because of that, I want to bring it up, and you can talk about it. and a few websites that I also looked at too. And very, very good subject to speak about, especially when someone wants to stack the antennas on the same band or different bands and so on. So I'll wait until you're ready for that. I'll mention that later on, Dick. Back to you.
Okay, I'm going to bring you guys up to speed. By the way, Andy, you could use a tiny bit more audio. You're about 80% of the audio you should have, and you could be a tiny bit louder. Andy is the very lucky guy that received his January issue of QST Magazine last Saturday. I haven't gotten my issue yet. My post office is still reading it. But Andy has already got his January issue. In there, he found two or three things. Mel, you're going to love this. Further articles on the Smith chart, the proper use of it. You're going to love that. Mel gives quite a few lectures on that subject. A very, very useful tool if you want to have a little more understanding on what a transmission line does. And when you first start studying transmission lines, you're going to say, wow, that's complicated. How can such a simple little structure, a twin lead 300 ohm transmission line that used to be used on television sets or modern coaxial cable, it's just a tube with a semiconductor going down the center, held together there with insulating material, how can that thing be so darn complicated? How come you put various resistors and capacitors at one end, and at the other end, you send something completely different, and the energy just doesn't flow down there the way you want it to. Some of the energy bounces back and forth. How in the world does a simple-looking little piece of transmission line do all that? Well, the Smith chart tries to explain it, and you'll have to dig in for a while even to understand it with that beautiful invention of 1938 by Mr. Smith of Bell Laboratories. He has this beautiful graphic tool that helps, but at first you're going to say, gee, why is it so complicated? Well, Mother Nature didn't design this universe for us to be easy to understand. So there's that article. There's also either in the Ask Mr. Wizard section, I keep forgetting what it's called, or the technical topics section, there's some articles on proper stacking of Yagis. Well, having been a Yagi builder from way back in the 70s, where I won some competitions with Yagi antennas starting in 1971, and then again from 1977 to 1984, one of the highest gain Yagis in the world with measured performance on a real antenna range was a so-called RIW design Yagi with 19 elements on 432 megacycles. So that plus I now hold patents in the last couple of years on modified Yagi design for the consulting business I'm involved in. So one of my clients now has in his name Yagi's a patent on Yagi antennas that also have my name on there because I'm the I was the principal investigator of that particular project. The Yagi antenna was invented way back in 1928, and it's kind of amazing. 75 years later, some guy with the chutzpah can come along and think he can redesign Yagi and make 54 claims, and 34 of those claims got granted by the patent office. So this is an exciting field. And so many of us have realized that the highest amount of gain per pound of aluminum, highest amount of gain per square foot of wind load, the highest number of dB of gain per dollar, all of those on VHF, UHF frequencies, the right answer is Yagi antenna. A dish, a horn, none of the other kinds of general antennas can give you more performance, more bang for the dollar than can a Yagi. So once you decide that Yagi is going to be your kind of antenna, and now you want more gain than you can get out of one single Yagi, the choices are to either make the Yagis longer or start horizontally stacking multiple Yagis or vertically stacking multiple Yagis or a combination of them. And what's the right stacking distance? Well, that's a function of what is their effective capture area. The capture area of a Yagi antenna is a lot bigger than the area you see when you look down that boom. It's a great big chunk of, it makes a great big hole in space, so to speak. And when the energy of the right polarization from the right direction comes roaring down that boom, a great big chunk of that energy gets folded into that driven element like a magnifying glass. That's what all those directors out in front are doing. So when it comes to the right stacking distance, you want to make sure those effective capture areas don't overlap each other. Otherwise, you're wasting the potential performance. So when Yagis are on the same frequency, like if I'm doing a stack of three Yagis on 2 meters, there's a certain recommended stacking distance. And the horizontal stacking distance and the vertical stacking distance is very similar, although slightly different, very similar. However, if I'm stacking a 2-meter Yagi, on top of that I have a 432 Yagi, And on top of that, if I have a 1296 Yagi, do you still look at those individual capture areas? And the answer is absolutely no. Those effective capture areas for each individual Yagi are only in existence on that particular polarization for that direction of arrival of the signal on that particular frequency. If I look down the throat of a 432 Yagi and it's got 5 square feet of effective area, 5.7 square feet is the effective area of an RIW 19 element 432 megacycle Yagi. 5.7 square feet, or it's 5.7 foot diameter circle. I forgot how the number of square feet of area it is. Anyhow, that's what the effective capture area looks like at 432. If you send a signal down that Yagi, that 432 meg Yagi, at 2 meters, and it doesn't have 5 foot diameter circle, it probably has a couple of inch diameter circle. The effective area goes to zero almost. As such, when I'm stacking a 432 Yagi on top of a 2 meter Yagi, the stacking distances can be much, much closer. I'm hoping that the article says something along those lines. I haven't seen it yet. And it really got my interest when you said that RIW is mentioned. I wonder how in the world they mentioned that. I've written lots of articles on lots of subjects, but not on the subject of stacking distance. Yeah, I published some articles on the microwave reflector on the World Wide Web on that subject, but never in formal print on any particular magazine. So I wonder how they brought my colon into that one, Andy. I'm going to pass it back to you. WA2CDL, K2RIW, the TechNet.
Dick, don't you want them to swallow away the parts so they don't see the SWR problem?
Good question. I'm going to give you an answer to that in a minute. Andy, first, go ahead.
All right. I just want to clarify. Are we finished with the last discussion? Because I know you called me and I just jumped in here. I wasn't sure if I was ready to give you some of this article that was written. Do you want to do this now, or do you want to just finish up what you were talking about before? Because I'm not sure if you completed that.
W2TTG. And then Andy Gazegov.
W2TTG.
Okay, Gordon's coming to a little bit better now. He's in a better location. There are only two guys that signed in with questions. That was Joe and Paul. And we've gone through 98% of Paul's discussion on his sensor for his Honda automobile. I think we've essentially finished it. We're going to be coming back to Paul by way of the space report, so Paul's going to have another crack at any further comments that he's got them on with reference to his sensor, Andy. I know that both Howie and, Howie's got a comment with reference to standing wave ratio between the antennas, an entirely separate subject, although certainly related to stacking distance. I'm going to say that. We're going to recognize that one. Gordon, while you're in a good location, don't overmodulate. Just talk at normal volume. Let's see if your signal can come through over there from the wilds of New Jersey. W2, Tango, 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 K2RIW, the Tech Net.
This is WS1. I just wanted to thank the Net. Great answers. Solved a lot of problems.
Very fine, Paul. Gordon, you got it?
Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that when we lost 220 to 222, I just, instead of having a 28 megahertz, I have moved my up to 30 megahertz. But we could output the 222 cleanly. So I just re-opened the transverter rather than recrystal the transverter. That was my point. So now I need radios to transmit at 30 megahertz, which any number do. With a mod, the 746 Pro that I have, the TS140S that I used to have, and now the Pro 3, the 56 Pro 3, will do that. The Pro 3 I haven't done a mod to because I can't find it, but it requires a Mars to potentially do that even when you're not an operator. And I happen to know ICOM will not release it to me, so I have to find another way of doing it. It's kind of silly, but that's the rules.
Okay, now it makes a lot more sense. Because of the dropout, before I only had half of the message. So to repeat what Paul was saying, is that he had a transverter. That's how an awful lot of ham radio operators get on the VHF, UHF, SHF frequencies, by way of a transverter, transmitting receiving converter. In the case of the 222 band, if you want to be on, in the old days, 220 megacycles was the ham band, and if you were using a 28 meg IF, that means one, let's see, if I subtract 28 from 220, I end up 112, I think it is. Here we go. 192. Alrighty. If the local oscillator in the transverter is 192 megacycles, and you mix 28 with that, you end up with 220 megacycles.